This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Before the civil war in Syria destroyed ancient religious sites and scattered some of the oldest Christian communities in the world, our first guest, Jason Hammaker, made several trips there, taking photos and recording ancient Sufi and Christian chants. The archbishop who once hosted him in Aleppo has since been kidnapped by rebels. The chaos and destruction have made Hammaker's documentation more important. He's planning a series of albums called Sacred Voices of Syria. The first, which was released this summer, is called Nawa, Ancient Sufi Invocations and Forgotten Songs from Aleppo. Hammaker isn't coming at this from the perspective of a musicologist or a member of a religious community. He's a drummer who's played in several punk bands in the Washington, D.C. area. He founded Lost Origin Productions to distribute his recordings and photographs. Terry spoke with Hammaker last Thursday and began with a track from the new album of Sufi Invocations and Forgotten Songs.
Allah. 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 Allah.
سبحانك يا هيم
الله
سبحان علام الغيوب
الله
سبحان مفرج الكروب
الله
سبحان ستار سبحان غفار الذنوب
الله
سبحان من لا تغير
الله
المدد يا عريض الجاه
الله.
It's music from the new album Nawa, Ancient Sufi Invocations and Forgotten Songs from Aleppo, recorded by my guest Jason Hammaker. Jason, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me.
I have to tell you, if I had to choose something to release as the single from the album, I would choose this. I think this would be a hit.
Yeah.
To put it in kind of pop categories. I mean, it's so catchy. What response is this music supposed to get? Like, this is a Sufi chant. Sufi
Correct.
Is considered like the mystical,
like the really, like the mystical
realm of
really
Islam.
Esoteric mm-hmm. form of Islam, and it is a way to align yourself and the group to God, a way to kind of really center and focus themselves towards God.
So set the scene for us when you recorded this. Where were you, and
sure.
who were the men who you recorded?
So I was in the city of Aleppo, which is one of the world's oldest continuously inhabited cities. You know, there's evidence that it at least goes back 8,000 years. And this is one of the last things I ever did in Syria before the war broke out. This is in 2010. And we all were there. It was a very informal, it really threw me off guard, actually, how informal everyone was. Like, two guys were kind of joking around. One guy was kicking the other guy in the pants. One guy was smoking. And then everyone left, and they all came back in these white robes, very kind of flowing robes, and everything changed at that moment. The entire vibe, the whole atmosphere of the place changed and became a very holy environment.
So who are the men who you recorded? Are they Sufi themselves, or is this just like a
sure.
musical project for them?
No, it's a combo of both. A handful of them have grown up in the tradition, and everyone, obviously, there's you're not like a professional Sufi. You know, some guys were leather workers, one guy was an architect. You know, all kinds of different things. And the group founder was actually 17 years old, and then his older brother, who was 21 at the time of recording, he is the main voice. And he was actually – he sung at a lot of the different Sufi lodges around the city. And a couple of them were professional musicians that, you know, held the Sufi beliefs, and they kind of banded together and created this ensemble. And to be honest, I had just met them and then had all these grandiose ideas of doing all this work with him and was never able to return.
Because of the war.
Because of the war. I mean, the war happened 3.5 months after this.
Jason, you're a punk rocker. I mean, you've played with several different punk bands in Washington. So what made you think of going to Syria to record ancient religious music?
So I was in a band called Decahedron, and that band broke up. And the next day I was at a friend's house, and we wanted to do something new with ourselves creatively. And so we came up with the concept of forming a rock orchestra with several of our friends to score music to some ancient chant. And it spun my mind completely in a million different directions and reminded me of a book that I had read called From the Holy Mountain by William Dalrymple, where he described in this book the world's oldest Christian music was what I remembered being in a monastery in the deserts of Syria.
So you actually contacted William Dalrymple, right? And what did you want to get from him?
So to my surprise, he actually responded within 4 hours. He was like, this is a great idea. Unfortunately, I don't have a copy of the music that you're looking for. If you ever go to Syria, this is what you tell a taxi driver at the airport in Aleppo. Good luck. And the piece of information that he told me that really changed everything was he said it's not a monastery in the desert. It is a Syrian Orthodox church in the middle of the city of Aleppo. So then I found an email address, info@SyrianOrthodoxChurch.org. And I did the same thing. Like, these are the books I read. This is the author I spoke to. I would love to get this music. And then 2 days later, the Archbishop of the United States for the Syrian Orthodox Church emailed me from Teaneck, New Jersey. He was very supportive and said that he did not have the music I was looking for. And I asked, well, where do I get the music that I'm looking for? And he's like, well, we don't have a CD to give you. It's like, meaning you just don't have one in the United States, or you don't have one, period. He's like, well, we don't have one. It's like, you've been doing this 1,800 years. There's no recording. He's like, no. I was like, do you want me to make one for you? And that was the genesis of how I started doing all of this, which snowballed into so many other things.
So in addition to recording the Sufi music that we've heard, you also recorded ancient Christian music in Syria.
Yes.
Including something that I want to play. And this is from a forthcoming album called Sacred Voices of Syria. And this is a version of the Lord's Prayer. Before we hear some of it, just tell us a little bit about this specific recording.
So this is the Lord's Prayer done in the Syriac language. And it is the Archbishop of Aleppo. It's his nephew, who's actually Chaldean Orthodox Christian, but worked at the church. So one night when the bishop was gone, they just got the keys to the cathedral, and we went in and recorded at like 1 a.m. It was one of the most sacred, really holy experiences I had in Syria. We went in, and it was the Cathedral of St. Ephrem, and this is what they started with as kind of the Lord's Prayer, the beginning of the chant recording.
And is it right to call this ancient music?
Oh, yes. Yes, this is ancient. Like, this tradition would be well over 1,000 years old.
Okay. Let's hear a little bit of it. This is the Lord's Prayer as recorded by my guest, Jason Hemacher, in Syria. He's not performing. He's recording two Syrian men doing this. One of them is the nephew of the archbishop?
Correct.
Okay.
Oh.
So that was recorded in the cathedral, and you can hear the echo.
Oh, yeah.
There's another song I want to play from your forthcoming album,
sure.
forthcoming series of albums of ancient Christian chants from Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And this is called the Alau Taro.
Correct.
And
you just spoke Syriac, by the way.
So what is Syriac?
Syriac is a form of Aramaic. It's the ancient language of the Near East, and it was...
So it's the language of Jesus' time.
Correct. And so it's the spoken language of the early church.
And where did you record this?
This is recorded... It took years to figure out how to record this. You know, Aleppo is noisy. There's cars everywhere. And I did this on an Islamic holiday, the night of Eid in 2008, when everyone was inside celebrating with their families. And the Cathedral of St. George's was too loud. So we did this in the hallway of their private school. And the whole recording was actually pretty amazing. So, we, you know, it's this huge moment, and the archbishop and an elder take a deep breath. And then we started doing the recording in broken glass. It was very cold. And, yeah, it was a pretty amazing experience.
Well, let's hear it. This is the Alau Taro from a forthcoming album of Syrian Orthodox Christian music.
Yes.
That will be on Smithsonian Folkways as recorded by my guest, Jason Hamaker.
Alau Taro
That's music from the Syrian Orthodox Church. It's very ancient music, as recorded in Syria by my guest Jason Hamaker, who's been trying to document various parts of Syrian culture, but that project was halted by the civil war.
Yes.
You know, listening to that, it sounds almost cantorial. It reminds me of some, like, Jewish music, some Hebrew music.
Of course.
You say, of course. Why do you say, of course?
Well, of course, meaning, you know, at the time when the Jews were meeting in a cave in Antioch, which was like an hour away from where I did the recording, they were Jews that believed, you know, like they hadn't called themselves Christians yet. Like that happened later. And so the theory is that this is the music between the bridge between the synagogue and the church. And there's very striking similarities between the two.
So are there many recordings of music from the Syrian Orthodox Church, like the ancient music from the church?
Yes. There's about 8 different traditions, and many of them are documented, except this one. And that is because this one tradition is only practiced in this one building on earth, and that's the St. George's Cathedral in Aleppo. Inside of this tradition, there are hundreds of chants, 900. It used to be thousands, and through war and everything else over the millennia, a good portion of these have been lost and forgotten. And so I wanted to record the individuals that know everything, not just portions, but the experts, the people that know all of it. And at the time of recording, there were 5. It's now down to 3. I mean, it's kind of a metaphor to everything that's been happening in Syria. It's like there's so much rich history and cultural relics that have been physically damaged, like bombs, bullets, war, death. But then there are all these amazing chants that can live on.
Jason, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Jason Hamaker spoke with Terry last Thursday. Hamaker recorded and produced the new album Nawa, Ancient Sufi Invocations and Forgotten Songs from Aleppo, and is the founder of Lost Origin Productions. This is Fresh Air Weekend. On the surface, Pinterest is a website and app that lets people gather images from their computers or the web and pin them to virtual boards organized around common themes. But Fresh Air's tech contributor, Alexis Madrigal, says Pinterest is more than just a digital scrapbook. He believes that Pinterest could become a legitimate competitor to Google, especially when you're searching for something but don't know exactly what.
The Pinterest interface is simple. Just click a button, and any web page gets broken down into its constituent images. Any of those can be added to your own set of images known on Pinterest as a board. Other people can find those boards and copy what they like, or simply search through all the photos on the site. Pinterest didn't take off among tech-loving men in California. Rather, it was young women away from the coasts who initially flocked to the site to plan everything from simple dinners to weddings. Now, it has tens of millions of users who have copied billions of pictures onto boards about everything from macrame to sports cars. Pinterest is mostly known as a place people go to find things to buy or make. The company likes to say that Pinterest is about planning your future. But it's also just about seeing visually a bunch of interesting stuff on a theme, all in one place. So there are boards for wedding planning and child rearing and men's linen suits, but also for kittens and model airplanes and mountains. Some boards are just a mood, like monumental or cute or adventurous. Despite this popularity, Pinterest has never attracted the same kind of press or adulation as the companies that grew up around the same time, businesses like Instagram, Uber, or even Dropbox. Pinterest just isn't seen as a hardcore technology company that will follow the path of Google and Facebook. To some people, it doesn't feel like a world-shaping product. It's just a digital scrapbook, people say. But internet companies are valuable in large part because of the kind of data that they possess. And Pinterest possesses some really, really interesting data. The first part of it is that they're a repository of things that people would like to have or do. They're a database of intentions, and that has got to be valuable to marketers and advertisers. But it goes deeper than that. What Pinterest has created, almost unintentionally, is a database of things in the world that matter to human beings. While Google crunches numbers to figure out what's relevant, Pinterest's human users define what is relevant for a given topic. And because of that, they could become a legitimate competitor to Google, the world's most valuable internet company. That idea crystallized for me when I saw a heavy Pinterest user playing with the service. She looked up nature photography, then started adding descriptors: winter, ocean, African. Each of these adjectives brought up an entirely different set of pictures, each with its own collection of moods and aesthetics. If what you're looking for is a thing or a type of thing out there in the world, Pinterest is more likely to serve it up to you than even Google. Frogs, sneakers, cloud formations, volcanoes, subway graffiti, footy pajamas. Google will deliver web pages about these things, but Pinterest will show you a photo of the thing itself, and increasingly the opportunity to buy it or get to it or experience it. By letting people copy and label images, Pinterest created this rich database of persons, places, and things. And they're just beginning to use that data to help people find stuff. With a programming team that's largely been hired away from Google, Pinterest has begun offering what it calls guided search. Pinterest co-founder Evan Sharp told me that guided search helps you find things you didn't know you were looking for. If Google is great when you know exactly what you want, Pinterest can help you figure out what you want. As you search, Pinterest will suggest tags that you could add to help narrow your query. Search for hats on Pinterest, and you might get fedora or baseball or church lady as suggestions. The lesson here is that the simplest things we do on the internet, when you multiply them by millions of people, create troves of data that were just inconceivable at any other time in human history. And in many cases, the companies who possess the data we've created over the past 5 years are still learning exactly how to harness it to do new things, whether that's making more money for themselves or delivering you up exactly the hat or photograph that you were looking for.
Alexis Madrigal is a visiting scholar at Berkeley's Center for Science, Technology, Medicine, and Society, and is the deputy editor of TheAtlantic.com. The more complex our personal technology gets, the more eager television is to take advantage of it. In the case of interactive TV, that now means the ability to vote on contestants and otherwise affect the outcome of what transpires, often in real time. But this new interactive wrinkle actually is as old as television itself. In fact, even older.
And voting couldn't be easier. With a simple swipe, blue for yes or red for no, these performers' dreams are in your hands.
Rising Star, which premiered this summer on ABC, is the latest singing competition series in primetime. It takes advantage of smartphone technology by offering viewers a special app with which they can vote in real time. And it sounds spiffy and new, a high-tech upgrade of the voting methods of shows like The Voice and America's Got Talent, and the granddaddy of them all, American Idol, which relied on interactive phoned-in votes from viewers to declare its first winner a dozen years ago, as announced by then co-host and now host Ryan Seacrest.
The winner of American Idol 2002 is... Kelly Clarkson.
But these modern shows that conduct their talent auditions in private or allow judges to cast heavily weighted votes during early rounds aren't really as interactive as they could be, or as they once were. The interactive talent show, it turns out, predates TV itself. In 1935, a local New York radio show went national, first on NBC, then on CBS, and offered listeners a chance to both phone in and write to determine the fate of its eager contestants. The program was called the Major Bowes Amateur Hour, and it quickly became one of the most popular radio shows of the 30s and 40s. That first year, in 1935, the show spotlighted four young men, one of whom was a 19-year-old kid named Frank Sinatra.
We have now the Hoboken Four. They call themselves the Singing and Dancing Fools.
Who will speak for the group?
I will. I'm Frank. We're looking for jobs. How about it?
How about it indeed? Before long, Sinatra didn't have to beg to get work. An amateur hour kept finding other talent, including a 10-year-old singer named Beverly Sills. In 1946, Major Bowes died. But his musical director, Ted Mack, transplanted the show's legacy to television in 1947, where Ted Mack's amateur hour became the first genuine hit on that new medium, even before Milton Berle. And TV's amateur hour was interactive from the start.
Well, I just wouldn't be fair if I started counting the votes that are coming in. I'll tell you all about it next week. As I say, they've all tried awfully hard. As far as you folks here in the theater are concerned, I want to thank you for encouraging them. You folks out there, well, you know how we feel about the amateurs. We want very much for you to support them with your votes. Let me repeat it once more, because we do have a new telephone number. It's Plaza 74100 here in New York. We have all of the pet milk operators up there waiting for them right now, and they'll be on duty for another half hour.
Another type of early interactive TV, also coming from radio, was Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts, a top-rated show that began on CBS Radio in 1946, moved to CBS Television in 1948, the first year CBS TV began operating, and lasted a full 10 years. Tony Bennett and Rosemary Clooney were among the acts that broke out on this show, which measured the applause of the studio audience to crown its weekly winners. Arthur Godfrey, the host, relied on a machine called the clapometer to gauge the response to each contestant.
Okay, thank you. And the violinist, Joseph Bernstein. Enjoy Carol.
There's no business like show business, like no business I know.
And Ingeborg Nordquist, the soprano.
Love is where you find it, don't be blind, it's all around you everywhere.
Well, there's no mistake about that one. The audience reaction indicator shows the winner tonight to be Ingeborg Nordquist.
The same clapometer gimmick was used on Queen for a Day, another TV show that made a successful transition from radio in the 40s. The horrible premise of this popular show was that women came on to compete for specific prizes of their choosing. But the winner was the woman whose life was deemed by audience applause vote to be the most pathetic. Here's host Jack Bailey interviewing one typical contestant.
How about children?
I have two.
Good for you. How old are they?
13 and 5.
Well, that's just wonderful. Now, Ms. Burke, I think you wish had something to do with one of the children, or both.
Yes. Huh? My boy.
Yeah, what's his name?
John Vernon.
Old John? What's the matter with old John?
Well, he's crippled up with cerebral palsy.
Is that so?
Yes, sir.
And he's now how old? 13?
13.
Yeah, he's had it quite a while. How can we help John?
Well, he needs a wheelchair and he needs a special bike for exercising.
Yeah. Had you promised him this by any chance?
Yes, I had.
Well, why didn't you keep your promises, Ma?
Well, I had to go to the hospital and have my legs operated on and had to quit working.
What were you doing?
Waitress work.
Oh, boy.
25
years, and that did it to your leg.
It sure did, yes. Mm-hmm.
And now you have to take it a little easier yourself.
Can't work. I'd sure keep my promise.
Bet you would keep your promise. Now, he's a 13-year-old boy, then he wants... Do you want a sort of a special bike?
Well, he needs it for exercising his legs. He's had quite a lot of surgery done.
Yeah. Ziva Birch, if you're our queen, we're going to get a wheelchair and a special bike, okay?
Thank you.
She won that week, which means she not only got her wish, but on TV, she was given a crown, a robe, and a royal fanfare.
I crown you Queen Ziva! Queen for a day, Queen Ziva Birch. Now, Your Majesty, if you just take your place up there on the throne, here comes the Duchess with your first gift, the Queen's bouquet of 4 dozen brilliant coronation red roses from our royal florist.
The clapometer was interactive in spirit, but not always in practice, where the dials often were manipulated by a crew member to rig the results. Finally, there was one other example of interactive TV from the early days of television. It was a CBS children's cartoon show from 1953, featuring a live-action host and a high-tech gimmick. The host was Jack Barry. The show was Winky Dink and You. And the gimmick was that young viewers were encouraged to get their parents to send away for a Winky Dink viewing kit, which included erasable crayons, a cloth, and a sheet of plastic to put over your TV set to draw things when you were instructed. In this episode of Dusty Dan Goes to Hollywood, for example, the cartoon character of Dan peeks through a hole in a wooden fence and witnesses a robbery taking place. He seeks help from the TV host, Jack Barry, who in turn seeks help from kids at home with their Winky Dink kits.
I'm giving you exactly 1 minute to turn over the rest of your money. I know you have more than this.
1 minute? Boys and girls, I've got an idea. Dan can't find something to throw over that fence. Whoever has the yellow Winky Dink crayon at home, stand by. You're going to draw right with your Winky Dink kits and draw that rock. Use your yellow Winky Dink crayon. Draw a round circle in Dan's hand. Just a round circle. Make it any size you want. Doesn't matter how well you draw it, as long as you complete it as soon as possible. Only 1 minute and time is flying by. Use your yellow Winky Dink crayon from your Winky Dink kit.
The troubling thing about Winky Dink and You was that whether you drew anything or not, Winky and his friends still went on about their business. And today's interactive TV shows work the same way. Even if you don't cast any votes for American Idol or Rising Star, there will always be a winner, until the show itself is canceled. Which, of course, is the ultimate exercise in interactive television. You can vote by not watching. Coming up, we talk with Allison Janney. She's up for 2 Emmys this year for her roles in Masters of Sex and the CBS sitcom Mom. This is Fresh Air Weekend. The Emmy Awards ceremony is coming up soon, August 25th. Our next guest, Allison Janney, is nominated for 2 Emmys. Outstanding Guest Actress in a Drama Series for her performance in Showtime's Masters of Sex, and Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Comedy Series for her role in CBS's Mom. She's already won 4 Emmys for her performance on The West Wing as White House Press Secretary C.J. Craig. Janney has been in many movies, including Primary Colors, American Beauty, Juno, and The Help. Terry spoke with Janney last Monday, and began with a scene from Masters of Sex, which is based on the story of William Masters and Virginia Johnson and the research they conducted into human sexuality starting in the late 1950s. Janney plays Margaret Scully, who's married to Barton Scully, the provost at a Washington University hospital where he supervises Masters' research. Margaret is frustrated that her husband shows no sexual interest in her. She's just learned that he's been seeing prostitutes, but she hasn't figured out that those prostitutes are men and that her husband is deep in the closet. Here they are at a drive-in movie. Her husband is played by Beau Bridges.
They didn't have drive-ins in our day.
We didn't need them. We were married when we first slept together.
We were of our time.
That's not why we waited. Burton. I have spent the day racking my brains, pacing, wondering. Maybe I should light his clothes on fire. Maybe I should drive his car into the pool. Maybe I should tell him all about the man I've been seeing, who, by the way, wanted me in his bed, though he didn't love me. I don't say this to punish you, although God knows you deserve to be punished. I mean, prostitutes? That is so insulting to me and so far beneath you.
I will never do it again, ever. I swear to you.
Even if you never laid a hand on a hooker again, that wouldn't change what is so impossible to understand. This morning, when you came in my room, I was practically naked, and you didn't look at my body once. Not once. And yet your face was filled with such love.
Because I love you. You know that.
We didn't sleep together before we were married because you weren't interested in sleeping with me. And I excused it away by saying passion is for teenagers and nymphomaniacs. Passion is not what makes a good marriage. This is a perfect, beautiful man who loves me, who doesn't care that I'm tall and athletic, who doesn't want me to act stupider than I am. This is a man who understands me.
And 30 years later, we're still the best of friends. How many people can say that?
It's not enough.
Alice and Jenny, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your two Emmy nominations.
Thank you, Terry.
I feel so bad for your character in her marriage, which is unfulfilled because her husband is so deep in the closet. They're both victims of the repression of homosexuality. You must find this character so interesting.
She was incredibly fascinating to play. One of my favorite in my career so far because of the different layers that are at work in every scene and how long it takes for her to really, she keeps getting fed lies more, you know, the closer she gets to the truth, more lies are flung at her until she, you know, finally is faced with the real truth of why her marriage isn't working.
She wants to participate in one of the Masters and Johnson's sex research studies, and then they're asking her all these questions about orgasm and what she experiences during sex. And what she experiences is pure tension, not like the release of the orgasmic release of tension. And
she seems so clueless about it.
Yeah,
I know. She gets asked, is there any release? And she said, oh, tremendous relief.
You know, yes,
she mishears the words.
Yes.
She's so glad when it's over. She doesn't understand. You know, she can't understand what they're getting at. She wants to say the right answers, of course, because she wants to be in the study. And then to realize in that moment in front of her husband's, you know, coworker that has never even had an orgasm before.
Since there is so much frank sexual talk on the show itself, do people end up making sexual confessions to each other on the set while killing time before the next scene is shot, just to kind of get in the spirit?
Yeah, it does kind of make for the situation is so awkward that you do have to become fast friends, or you look for anything to be comfortable with your scene partner. And maybe that's, you know, sharing some silly thing that happened with you in bed, you know, your first time or whatever, just anything to break the ice. And I was not afraid to ask for. I had to ask for just a little shot of courage before I had my first sex scene with Teddy Sears, who was just the most gorgeous, wonderful, handsome specimen.
This
of
is
man.
The this is the younger man who you have an affair with.
Young man who. Yes,
you're not getting anywhere with your husband.
I'm not getting anywhere with my husband, and I decide I'm going to, you know, and he falls into my lap, so to speak, and I sort of go there, and it's wonderful for the audience to see Margaret Scully have her first orgasm on, you know, not so much for my mother on television, but, oh, my God.
Did you need a shot of courage for the scene or a shot of liquor?
Well, that's what I mean when I say courage.
Okay,
when I say courage, just a little shot of bourbon. I didn't even know. I didn't know what they had. I just asked, you know, for something. And
yeah, whatever.
I just wanted something to just take the edge off because I was beyond nerve. Who gets to do a sex scene when you're 50? Whatever. You know, no one really gets to. Not too many women get to do that. So, the worst part is, I think, doing the run-through for the crew when they come in. And you have a private rehearsal, and they're very great on Masters of Sex to keep the set very private and respect everyone. And you sort of go through the numbers with the director. And then they invite the crew in because they have to see it in order to, you know, boom it and light it and do it. And that's the part that just feels so weird. You know, I was like, can we just go by the numbers here and show them? And the director's like, no, you got to show them what the action is so they know what, you know, is... Like, okay, all right, here we go. You know, you try to make fun of it and just dive in.
So I think a lot of people first got to know you as CJ, the press secretary on The West Wing. Let's hear a scene from that. And this is a scene, President Bartlett had MS, but he was not telling people about it. And in this scene, Oliver Platt, who plays the White House counsel, has learned that the president has MS and has been keeping it from the public. And he's trying to figure out who on the White House staff knew and has been helping in the cover-up and who didn't. So here he is questioning you about whether you participated in covering up that information.
Okay.
Have you ever lied about the president's health?
Should I have my lawyer here?
I'm your lawyer.
You're the president's lawyer.
I'm the White House counsel, CJ. Have you ever lied about the president's health?
When did he tell you?
I'm sorry?
When did the president tell you?
6 days ago.
And Josh?
2 days after that.
Toby?
2 days before he told me. CJ, have you ever lied about the president's health?
And Leo, he told more than a year ago.
Yeah.
And I've had this for 6 hours now, so maybe giving me some room wouldn't be totally out of line. You know what I'm saying, Oliver?
CJ, I'm gonna have to ask you some questions. Less you can be pissed at the world for no particular reason, the better, I think.
I don't know you.
I'm sorry?
I was told to report to you. I don't know you. You've been here, what?
3 months.
3 months. So
yeah.
Why should I trust you?
Well, I don't care if you trust me or not.
Imagine my shock.
I've got better things to do with my imagination.
I think this is going really well so far, Oliver. It's almost hard to believe that 4 different women have sued you for divorce.
Well, you can do that if you want, CJ. I've been through it a couple times with Josh and Toby, but sooner or later you're going to have to answer questions.
Either to you or...
A grand jury.
Compelled by...
A Justice Department subpoena.
Well, I have to tell you, it'll be the first time I've been asked out in quite a while, so...
It's entirely possible that the president has committed multiple counts of a federal crime to which you were an accomplice.
That much has sunk in the last 6 hours.
Has it?
Yes.
So why don't you knock off the cutie pie crap and answer the damn question?
What was the question?
Have you ever lied about the president's health? What is your answer?
Many, many times.
Ooh, CJ in trouble.
It's my guest Allison Janney with Oliver Platt in a scene from The West Wing. So I always wonder, when you do that kind of snappy retort type of Aaron Sorkin dialogue, does it improve your ability to have witty retorts in real life and to have razor-sharp dialogue when you're speaking extemporaneously?
Oh, Terry, would that were true. Unfortunately, that was the biggest disappointment, that just didn't just, you know, seep into my skin and my brain, and I was able to just speak like Aaron Sorkin writes the minute I left that show. But no, I can't, I don't have that. I don't have that razor wit that CJ had. Politics scared the crap out of me because I did not grow up in a family where we talked about anything really, but, you know, pass the peas and do this. And, you know, we didn't really have political discussions at the dinner table. I had no idea what I was talking about half the time. And I have to, you know, I'd study my lines and read and like, going, what the hell am I talking about? What, I learned a great deal doing that show and I loved it, but I felt just really fish out of water when we'd go to Washington and be, you know, go out to dinner. I'd meet the, you know, the former press secretaries and sitting around with Dee Dee Myers and Joe Lockhart and talking. I just would just get so nervous. I wouldn't know what to ask them. So I felt a real pretender to the throne.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Allison Janney. I want to play what was a very small part in an independent film called Margaret, which was written and directed by Kenneth Lonergan. Mm-hmm. And your performance in this is really incredible, even though it's so short. And mm-hmm. So here's the scene. The main character in this is played by Anna Paquin. She's a teenager who September 11th has just happened. She really is very confused. She's kind of experimenting with her own sexual power. And she's been flirting with a bus driver as a bus drives by. And because he's distracted by her, he ends up going through a light and hitting you. You're a mm-hmm. pedestrian. Mm-hmm. And the Anna Paquin character is so upset at what's happened. She runs over and finds you lying on the ground. One of your legs is actually under the bus, like kind of mm-hmm. amputated under the bus. And she's trying to help you, and here is the scene.
Call an ambulance. Everybody just step back.
I'm calling one right now.
Get an ambulance.
Someone's calling one.
Ma'am, can you hear me? Can you hear me?
I don't know. Where am I?
You're on Broadway and 75th Street.
Broadway between 75th and 74th Street. Who are you?
My name is Lisa.
What do you mean? Am I dead?
No, you're not dead. You're in a traffic accident, but you're going to be okay.
I don't have a direct address. She's out in the street. What do you mean? What happened?
You were run over by a bus.
You've got to be kidding me. A bus?
Yeah.
Is there a doctor?
So where am I now?
Anywhere.
An ambulance is on its still way. Still happening?
No, I mean, yes, the accident's over, but I think you're a little confused.
I'll say I'm confused.
Here, let me try to see if
no!
I can.
It's such a riveting scene. And, you know, I when I was growing up, there were a few blocks that didn't have stoplights or traffic lights, and that had a lot of car accidents. And car accidents, the sound of those cars crashing mm-hmm. when I was young mm-hmm. is still in my mind and still just terrifying to me. I'm wondering if you kind of drew on stuff like that in this role, just the kind of horror of like one of the most dreaded things as a pedestrian.
I didn't know how I was going to play that scene, and I really depended on Kenny Lonergan. He really gave me some good things to think about or to play. Like he would say, "Oh, be angry now," or just show the complete what it must be like to be in. Having been hit by a bus and not feel like it, but just be incredibly confused and not worry. All I knew is that I was covered in blood, this, you know, stage blood, out on 75th and Broadway in front of Citarella's. I was there on the street in blood for the whole day. I just sort of lived in the life of just being there in that blood. It was one of the weirdest scenes to film, and it wasn't like any other scene I've ever played because it wasn't like, I don't know, I was doing so many different things in it.
Well, you know, you said that Kenneth Lonergan kept feeding you like direction, like do it angry. And you could have done the same lines in a kind of confused, questioning way, like instead of it being that kind of angry, controlling, like, what do you mean, a bus?
Yeah.
It could have been like, what do you mean, a bus?
Yeah.
You know, so, but I felt that doing it that kind of like angry, controlling, tough New Yorker way told so much about your character, even though this is all we see of you, because you die in that scene.
Yeah, that's it. I knew. I mean, it was funny when Kenny asked me to do it. I read the scene. I was like, well, at least I know I won't get cut. You know, I knew it was going to be in the movie because it was, you know, what the whole movie moves forward because of that moment there. So, but it was interesting, and I really am grateful for his help.
So how tall are you?
I am, you know, I say 5'12". Ha ha. I'm definitely six feet. And in my heels, I'm six three. Yeah.
Now, how did that affect you as a teenager, and how did it affect you as a young actress when you were getting started?
Well, it was all, you know, I went to a school with, like, you know, first through 12th grades, under 300 kids, this school called Miami Valley School in Dayton, Ohio. And I was just, you know, so tall. And it wasn't until I went to college, to Kenyon College, that I, you know, started having my first date. So I was a sort of a late bloomer in a lot of things. And I feel like my career started late. And I think it was because of my height and maybe some of my confidence issues. But I, you know, was playing 40-year-old women when I was 20, when I was, you know, and I just, I didn't get considered for ingenue roles, or I just wasn't, I don't know, maybe I just wasn't ready, or things started happening when I was, I think when I turned 38, I started to have a career. So, you know, I think my height probably did have something to do with it, but it's also helped me in get in certain parts. I think it's made me definitely more of a character actress in terms of my love of doing comedy, or being, you know, I get cast as either the smartest woman in the room or the drunkest woman in the room. Those are the two. A lot of stuff in between, but I do well in getting those kind of parts, authoritative or completely crazy, which I love. I love both of those kinds of roles.
Well, now you're nominated for 2 Emmys, and that must be pretty great.
I'm really proud of both of these nominations, because the projects are both, they're just so different, and I got really lucky to be able to show myself as in these two very different women at the same time.
Well, I wish you good luck with
Terry.
With
thank
the
you.
Emmys. It's really been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Allison Janney speaking with Terry last Monday. Janney is nominated for 2 Emmys, one for her performance in Showtime's Masters of Sex, the other for her performance in CBS's sitcom Mom. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.